shall touch faith.
Hello, carnies, and welcome to another episode of Sideshow. This is Jacques.
This is Joe.
And via Skype, we have our friend
Jenna Rose Robbins.
There we go. We have Jenna on today because, she's a very interesting person, and not just interesting as compared to Joe or myself, actually an interesting person. She is an author and a, no exaggeration, a world traveler and a friend for 15 years? 16 years?
Something like that. Yeah, I can't believe it. Thanks for dating me.
Hey, I've dated a lot of people. Oh, anyways. we're going to talk all about, like, you know, Jenna's background and career, and we'll bring it up to the new book that she has, all about her love and obsession with Depeche Mode. But first, a little background. Like, we met when you were, I believe, were you the travel editor for AOL City Guide? Is that what the title was back then?
Yeah, I was a senior editor for City Guide, and I covered a whole bunch of cities, and which always changed everywhere from Vegas to L.A. to Denver. I basically managed the freelancers there, so it was a lot of fun. I got to do a lot of traveling and meet a lot of great people.
So for anybody under 30, do you want to quickly explain what AOL was?
AOL basically was the internet back in the day. That was pretty much how everyone logged on when they dialed up by old school modem. And we were basically the guide. It was almost like the TripAdvisor of the U.S. at that time. We only covered the U.S. And it was a really great place to work. And it was great because it was in Los Angeles, in Santa Monica specifically. So we were far, far away from the mothership in Dulles, Virginia. And so our office was everything you could expect of a L.A. office of just a whole bunch of creative people who were working three blocks from the beach. People would roll in around 11, you know, hungover from Konya concerts the night before that they were going to be covering. And I'd walk around with, you know, barefoot or with kittens under my desk. I think I brought kittens up to your office a few times. It was a really great place to work. And as much as we complained about it back then, it was still one of the best jobs I ever had. It was just so much fun. The people were great. The work was great. And, you know, we didn't realize how good we had it at the time.
Well, it is funny because I was telling Joe just before we went on, my company had one side of the third floor of a building and your and AOL had the other half. So that's how we met, truly coming up and down an elevator. And as loose as your office was, ours was as close to Animal House as you can get legally. And again, what Jenna was saying, it was three blocks from the beach in Santa Monica. Less than one block from a Hooters, which is where we held most of our meetings. So it was a really fun time. But with AOL, you did a lot of traveling with that. So were you traveling before that professionally, or was it a hobby before that? What point did you start like traveling a great deal and getting other people to pay for it?
Well, before that, I had done semester at sea, which is a college program, study abroad program, where you're on a ship and you travel around the world for 3.5 months and visit all these different countries. And we literally circumnavigated the globe and went to 10 different countries on, I think, 3 or 4 different continents. And ever since I did that, my whole goal was to get back on that ship in some way, shape, or form, either working or go back and study again. But I did get hired from one of their shorter term programs at one point that brought me around the Caribbean and South America. And I had got to all I had to do was blog and Facebook and tweet the whole time. And we had really amazing keynote speakers on the ship because it was still a very educational program that I was on. So I got to interview Sandra Day O'Connor and Julian Bond. And that was probably like my first foray into doing that. But in other ways, I was getting press trips, offers for press trips. So I got to go to a lot of places for that, which I would then write up for various outlets. And that's kind of what a travel writer does the most, is they do travel, and a lot of places don't accept articles written based on press trips. So sometimes I would do something like I went diving with great white sharks, and I wrote about that for AOL, and that got to be on the AOL home screen, which at the time was almost like the home screen of Google. I mean, it was the biggest thing, the most trafficked individual page on the entire internet. So I got all this fan mail back then for my great white shark story. And ever since then, I've been working for various outlets. When I just came back from living in Germany for a few years, I worked for a magazine over there that was found in all the high-end hotels across the city. And so I got to learn the city really well just by getting assignments to go out and try restaurants, try different nightclubs and all that stuff. And I got to write about it. So it was wonderful.
You got paid to live in Germany and got paid to go to really nice hotels and restaurants.
Right. Everything was taken care of. It was all comped. And I had to cover that stuff. And so it was really fun. I mean, to be honest, the travel writing world doesn't pay very well, but the perks you get are great. So that's why I've always supplemented my income with doing ghostwriting and writing other things of that nature. So the travel writing does not pay the bills, for me at least. There are very few people who I think can claim that. But it's so much fun that I can't stop doing it.
And what would you say your top three favorite destinations are in the world, aside, of course, from the United States?
Oh, God, USA, it's so hard to USA. Depends on what you're saying for. Like, is it to go, like, go see concerts? Is it to go scuba diving? I mean, it's so, there's so many places in the world, and they're so wonderful. But Spain is one of my favorite countries. It's just, I love the whole, any place that siestas and fiestas, I mean, it's got to be a great place. Sri Lanka, I've spent quite a bit of time there, and that's a country I think so many people don't know about and really, really should, because it's still very undiscovered. It's not as touristic as other places. Oh, there's so many places. And then there's the worst thing is, as I travel more, my list of places I want to go to gets bigger, not smaller, because I discover all these other places I want to go to.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I have only traveled myself to Ireland, to the Azores, and to Canada. So my depth of charting the globe isn't as broad as, say, you or Jacques. So I'm just interested. You know, I just want to know where I should be spending my second honeymoon with my wife. Where I should be fleeing to if Trump were to get elected for another term. That sort of thing. I'm just planning ahead.
Oh, all those things, I have those mapped out for you. We can talk offline about that, because I frequently get people asking me, where should I go for this? Where should I do that? Actually, I just helped a mutual friend of ours, mine and Jacques, decide to move abroad, because now that Trump was elected, he decided he can't raise his kid here. So he actually got Italian citizenship and he's going to be moving over there.
Oh, that would be our friend Mike, who's going to be a future podcast. So, no, it's funny because more and more people jokingly say this. And I'll send you the picture, Jenna, and I'll post it for our three podcast listeners. When I was in Qatar a year and a half ago, because my last name is Lambert, everybody thought I was Canadian. I never went out of my way to correct people. And we had a big tournament where they put together there was enough Swedes to have a Swedish team, enough Finns to have a Finnish team, a Canadian team in this league, and we hosted Kuwait's national team, Bahrain's national team, Qatar's national team played in this tournament. And because of my flowing locks, I have a on-ice resemblance of the Hansen brothers. And the MC for the finals was the ambassador from Canada to Qatar, who in between the first and second periods, one of his assistants came down to the bench and he wanted to take a picture. And it's funny because this was during the primaries and I had said to him, hey, if the unthinkable happens and Trump becomes president, you know, will you help me get citizenship? And he laughed and then he's like, you know, you're not the first to ask that. And I said, well, I am glad to help build your wall in case such a thing happens. So, I want to get back to AOL for a second. Joe, did you have AOL?
Of course I did. It came in the mail with free samples of Tide.
Do you still have an AOL account, Jenna?
I do. I don't think I've logged into it in years, but because I have my full name at AOL, JennaRoseRobbins@AOL.com, I didn't want to give it up. But I know that a lot of people, a bunch of my friends are still, didn't, they would tell me that they still had an AOL account. And I'd say, you're not paying for that, right? Because it's free now. And they're like, what? So just so you know, anybody out there, if you're paying for your AOL address, it's free. You just have to tell them, please stop billing me for something that's free.
I have a Prodigy account. Is that bad?
But it's funny because a friend of mine recently went to a how to boost your resume seminar. And he came back and he's like, one of the tips that they told people, if you have an AOL email address, do not use that on your resume because it dates you.
Yeah.
You know, so they're like, anybody under 40 using AOL, and no one, generally speaking, under 40 uses it. And it's funny because management still has your AOL account. And when she was in Doha, somebody asked her, was like, oh, is that a new thing? Because they had never heard of AOL before, you know, but that's still the primary email address. And I'll be honest, I haven't used it in 15 years, but I got an email about a week or two ago, AOL letting everybody know that as of the end of the year, they're doing away with AOL Messenger.
Yes, that's how that was our primary way of communicating when we were there. We used Messenger like every single day. We barely sent emails within the office. It was all through Messenger. Even back then, you could say they were able to pull up old instant messages. And I remember there was a lawsuit that went on in my office, and they started pulling up Messenger transcriptions and repeating them to people. And they're like, we didn't know you kept those. And that was, you know, the first time I realized, yeah, nothing is ever deleted.
Yeah, Jacques is still on my buddy list.
but so after AOL, and then when you went to C, now just to be really clear, it was what was the program called that you were on? It was not Scientology Sea Org that you were out there selling around the world with, correct?
No. It was I did semester at C as an undergraduate, and then I did. Then for a while there, they had a program called Enrichment Voyages. In between semesters, when students went and actually took classes, they had to do something with the ship. So they would have these enrichment voyages that anybody could go on. They were basically very educational cruises. And, you know, you would take wine tasting and salsa classes and Spanish lessons. And there was somebody who was from Sonoma State University who was teaching about environmental stuff. And it was so much fun. And it was a small ship, so it was a very nice, close-knit community. That's where I worked as the blogger and the tweeter. And unfortunately, Enrichment Voyages doesn't exist anymore, but Semester at Sea does. And I was the LA chapter rep for Semester at Sea for over a decade. And I would tell all the kids when they got on the ship, it's the 100 best days of your life, and it's all downhill after that. So make sure you make the most of every single day that you're on this program.
Well, I remember because I was trying to explain this. Joe and I just had lunch, and I was trying to explain it. I'm like, yeah, because we had talked to like some of the people, you know, again, like Mike, who's had a rich background in like music or whatever, be an interesting guest. My friend Ross, the, you know, tenured professor at Maryland. And now, like, we're trying to think of interesting people. Now, it's not a luxurious cruise thing. It's kind of, how would you describe it? So it's not like going on a princess cruise.
It wasn't back when I did it. We called ours the floating cardboard box that we had a row around the world. But now they have a new ship. They've had two or three ships since I sailed back in 95. And each one has been progressively nicer. And the latest ship I have not been on, but I've seen pictures. And it was a cruise ship that they've converted now into a floating campus.
Now, some of the stuff, and I will let the listeners know, first of all, I'll clarify this to myself a few times. When Jenna says she's a ghost writer, you're not writing ghost books, correct?
That is correct. It just means I help someone write a book, or I completely write a book for somebody else. And I don't get credit for it, and I can't even tell you who I've written it for.
Now, because I've known Jenna, because Jenna and I have worked on projects and written stuff together, I know a lot of the books she's written that I won't mention, but I will say one of my favorite quotes is, "You've written books for people who can't read."
Yes, a lot of the process entails just interviewing them, kind of like what you're doing with me right now. I record it, transcribe it, and try to make their words into something that is credible and comprehensible and enjoyable. And
could you do the same for our podcast?
Yeah, could you write it?
So that's how I work with a lot of people. And I've written books, I've ghostwritten books on so many topics, everything from religion to sports to business to pretty much every topic. And it's fascinating because I get to learn so much about each of these topics that I never would have learned about before. Right now, I also do web consulting, so I am helping a client in Southern California with, he does environmental compliance. So the stuff I'm writing about is like all these air permitting rules. And it's like, I had no idea that like if someone put in a coffee roaster, you had to do this stuff. So it's just so fascinating, and I meet such wonderful people. What took me to Europe originally was I went over there, I met somebody on the Enrichment Voyage, and he was a French chef, and he then owned a bed and breakfast in Brittany. And he had a book that he wanted me to edit about how he kind of basically introduced French food to the Midwest in the 60s and 70s. So I was just learning about all that was just so fascinating. I got to live in France for 2 months while I helped him work on this book. And that's what brought me over there. And then I realized I don't have to go back to the U.S. My place is rented out on Airbnb and I can just stay. So I ended up staying for 3 years.
And with some of the other stuff, and again, because of NDAs, you've also been a ghostwriter with speeches and stuff for political people, with seriously giants of different industries, and you've gotten to travel a world of like private planes and absolutely mind-numbing. Are you ever going to be able to write about some of those travels and some of those stuff, or are these NDAs like in 60 years you still can't say, oh, I was writing for this person and got to do X, Y, and Z?
I probably can never talk about the majority of them. And actually, somebody else who I worked with on one of the big projects, he and I, whenever we meet, we're like, when are we going to write our book about X, Y, and Z? And because some of the stuff that happened, we just couldn't believe it. It was happening at the time. And some of the events were just so ridiculous and over the top. And I wish I could talk about them because some of them are just so hysterical, but I can't. And, you know, the reason I don't do it because this way other people trust me and they know that I'm not going to talk about it and I get more gigs that way.
What's interesting to me is that how one gets into ghostwriting, because if you're not credited, and I guess it's more of an inside industry thing, but how does your name get around? Where do people approach you and say, they see your prior works and say, hey, I like the way your writing style is and I'd like for you to, you know, help me write my book, aka write my book for me. And then does your name then get passed around within the industry circle saying, oh, you know, Jenna has written for this person, this person, this person, should be a really good author for, you know, your project. How does one get into ghostwriting?
Well, I originally started ghostwriting as a ghostwriter for a ghostwriter who had...
Oh my God, this is like Inception.
I know.
It's a dream. It's a dream.
And he now has a business that, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say his business. I would love to let people know about it because it's great, but I won't say it just because I'm not sure if I'm allowed to. He now has a business where he helps people ghostwrite books, and he does 75 books a year.
Whoa.
And so he has to outsource. There's no way one person, I don't care who you are, Jean Le Carré or whoever you are, you're not going to be able to put out 75 books a year on your own. So he has a stable of writers who help do these books. And so I did that for several years, and that's where I did my first 10 books or so, and two of those became New York Times bestsellers. And so he was always just giving me new projects because of that. And actually, he had the whole art down to it was such a science that he had the process that I was able to do 4 books in 4 months. I wrote 4 books in 1 summer.
I can't read 4 books in 4 months.
And one of those was somebody who was, I think the person I mentioned to Jacques is the person I didn't even think could read.
What sport did he play? Just,
yeah, I didn't say anything.
But and then other times, like I've been working with another client for a while, and she just said, oh, I have a friend, they're both big in their industries. She had a publishing deadline and she had 3 more chapters to write. She's like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this in 2 months. So she outsourced a few chapters to me. And then she referred me to somebody else and they referred me to somebody else. And it turns out all these people want to write books because they want to get their name out there. A lot of people aren't writing books to make money, to become bestsellers. They're writing them to be almost as calling cards, to be able to say, hey, I wrote the book about this topic and I'm the person who knows the most about this. And that's why they're doing it. So a lot of people are willing to pay people because it's like a marketing project for them.
What's your opinion? I'm just thinking out loud. What's your opinion on the person who came out as the ghostwriter for Donald Trump, The Art of the Deal? What's your opinion of him coming out and publicly saying that he, you know, regretted ever doing it? He felt kind of dirty taking his money and that sort of thing. And what do you think about eventually like outing yourself as a ghostwriter?
Personally, I don't think I could ever do it because I'm so paranoid. I'm afraid of ramifications, legal ramifications, what have you. If he felt that way and he felt comfortable saying that, and he didn't feel that anything he was going to get any, I'm thinking like physical retribution on him, then I think it's fine that he said it. Because I think, but either way, like it's not like anyone knew it was him. So he was never going to take the brunt of, you know, hey, you're the jerk who did this. So I don't see why he came out in that sense, because no one knew it was him. No one was ever going to point the finger at him. But if he felt that he needed to get it off his chest, then go for it.
What's interesting is that you just touched on, Jenna, is I have a friend who's a big corporate guy who is a very interesting person. And I've been trying to basically push him into the world of he does some speaking engagements, but he's somebody who could probably do a speaking engagement somewhere on the globe every week. And when we sat down with a couple people to kind of put together a portfolio on them to kind of start this thing. One of the things that was suggested is like, you have to write a book. You have to, you know, it's one of those things. It's like you said, it's a calling card. And, you know, if you know how to kind of game the system and, you know, what time of the year you release it and where you release it and what kind of PR you get behind it, it's not as much of a daunting task to get like a best-selling book now as it might have been like 15, 20 years ago. And people were saying, it's like, no, it really, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, how much the book sells. You just need to be able to say in your title, you've done X, Y, and author type thing. So I think that's why it's, you know, a lot more people have done this. And you've probably done more than your fair share of books that the person wasn't really interested in the book so much as what door the having a published book opened.
Well, and that's, yes, and that's definitely something where when I'm ghostwriting, I always try, obviously, always try to make the book as good as possible. I want it to be strong. I'm proud of my work. But there are some people who just want to rush it out. And thankfully, if my name were on the book, I would never let that happen. If I were co-authoring it, which I've done a few times, I would never just rush it out. But some of them, they don't care. They're like, I don't care. I just want to get the book out. And I'm like, okay, it's your project. You get to decide. But if my name's going on the book, then we're going to take our time and make this as good as possible, which is why it took me so long to get my book out. My book was actually finished 5 or 6 years ago. And I was just, there were several things I was worried about. I was worried about libel, and I also felt there was something missing. And I finally figured out what that was and added it to the book. And then after years and years of working on it, I got it out. But I think that's part of it too, is, you know, when you're ghostwriting, you feel ownership of the project, but you don't, it's not as much as if it's your project. As much as I try to make everyone feel like my project, some of them, if the client doesn't care so much, then how am I supposed to care as much?
And we do. We want to spend most of the end of this getting to your book. But it's interesting. It is a bummer that you can't mention a lot of the stuff, because I've gotten to do a lot of cool things just because some of the people you've worked with. And it's like, you know, off the air, I've told Joe about like some of the people, you know, I've been in small, like, you know, cheese and wine tasting, like, you know, rooms with that had only like 15, 20 people. And I'm looking around the room and thinking, hey, I'm the only one in this room with net worth under $1 billion. So it is. There has to be part of that that just like, oh, I want to be able to say, I've done this, I've gone here, I've worked with this. There's got to be a part of you that like, oh, I just wish I could, you know, brag a little, name drop a little.
I remember we were at one. It was a book launch for one of my clients. And you and I went to one, and I remember Dennis Hopper was right before he died. He was walking around, and first of all, I couldn't believe how short he was. But then I was like, I'm like inches away from Dennis Hopper. And you and I have gone to a lot of things together. I mean, we did, you know, all that stuff with, you know, I don't know if I can say any of the ones that you and I have worked on. Now
oh yeah, no, you know, you definitely can. You know, I mean, if you did, and it came from another voice, maybe Joe would believe I actually did these things.
Oh, I was just telling someone the other day, I was actually at the chiropractor, and someone mentioned Billy Ray Cyrus, and I was like, oh my God. And I had to tell them some of the stories about what we did with him back then. And the whole thing with metal school, that was one of the funniest things I've ever experienced.
The metal school thing, we should do a podcast just on metal school, who, by the way, I saw in Boston a couple months ago. It was great, but here you're going to find this disappointing. All originals. And now, granted, all the originals sounded like 83, like, metal songs. I mean, they were still all nothing but, like, you know, over-the-top, like, sexual innuendos and puns and, you know, double entendres and stuff like that. But I kind of want them to do their whole, like, white steak medley and all that stuff. They incorporated a lot of the same gags in between the songs. Here's the disappointing thing. They played at the House of Boston, and it was packed. And God bless them. Seriously, to go from when we started seeing them at the Viper Room on Monday nights at midnight, it only holds 100 people, and we knew most of the people in the room when they played. Now the House of Boston was packed, and this is a disappointing thing. It's become complete frat boy rock. Like, I'm going to say, like, the whole floor, 90% of it was males under 25, like, either from BU or BC, and it did. It took on this whole comedy, cool, eclectic vibe to this whole meathead rock type thing. But, you know, God bless him. But the funny thing with Billy Ray is, like, you know, I'm still working with him, and as of now, he called me.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I thought you've severed that tie so many times.
So many times. But what's interesting is we have a working with him opens doors that it's hard to put into words. You know, to be able to talk when I deal with like NFL teams. By the way, Joe last weekend went with me and we worked a Jets game with Constantine from Idol. But still keeping the relationship with him opens so many doors. On the other hand, it is. It's completely frustrating. But every now and then I'll hear from him and he wants his daughter Noah, who is Katy Perry's opening act on the U.S. leg of her world tour, to start doing anthems with him. And I have them doing a Clippers game at the end of this month. So it is funny kind of the stuff. And one of the projects that Jen and I worked on, we wrote a spec script for Hannah Montana, which was pretty awesome.
I still think it was really great. And by the way, when I was listening to other podcasts of yours from a few weeks ago, someone mentioned how Eminem had rhymed the word orange in his rap about Trump. And remember, part of one of our little scenes was all about how they were trying to rhyme all these different colors that had no rhymes. It was, one of them was orange and silver and purple. And I just thought it was so funny that Eminem came up with a rhyme for orange.
Well, Eminem's smarter than me. What can I say? You know, that's not saying much. Okay, so now we've got all that out of the way. Do you got anything before we jump into our book?
No, I want to get into Faithful and Devoted.
Faithful and Devoted, Confessions of a Music Addict. And it's all about my time. It's only a week long. It's only a week of my life where I followed Depeche Mode around Spain and got into a whole bunch of trouble.
So right there, only a week touring with your favorite band around the country that earlier you said was one of your three favorite places to be. So greatest week of your life?
It's up there. I mean, there's still moments I think about on a regular basis, and some of them I cringe. Like I'll be by myself and I'll think about them and I'll just blush and be like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And I mean, it's now over 20 years ago, so it almost feels like I was a different person. It was a whole lifetime ago, it feels like. So I think that's one of the other reasons I felt better about writing the book now, is I was able to say things in there that I didn't really care about anymore. I mean, I was young. I was 19. I did stupid things. Everyone does stupid things at 19.
Ours are on videotape.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so some of mine were too. And my mom actually read my book, and she wouldn't speak to me for a while because she was pretty mad about some of the things in the book. So no, it was. I'm glad I put it out there, and I was very excited that I entered it into the Book Life Prize, which is the independent publishing arm of Publishers Weekly, which is the biggest trade magazine in the publishing world. So I entered it into the Book Life Prize, and the last few months it's just been making it through different rounds, and now I'm one of seven finalists.
Congratulations.
So it's taken you a while to write this, because since I've known you, you've been talking about writing this book. How many versions of this did you write before you published this one?
Well, originally I went to grad school at USC for professional. They had a professional writing program. The program has been killed off, or actually moved to another school. But it was a great program. And I wrote for one of my nonfiction classes, I just wrote this memoir piece that was probably about 12 pages just about this incident. And I got so much great feedback on it. And then my thesis advisor said, you have to make this the book that's going to be your thesis to graduate. And I had gone to the program with the intention of writing a completely different book that has a travel book, nothing to do with this. But because I was still working at AOL at the time, I didn't have that much time to write, going to grad school half time too. By the time my final two semesters came up, I said, oh crap, I have to come up with a thesis. What's the easiest thing for me to write in two semesters? Okay, I guess I'll do this book. So I originally wrote that, finished writing the whole book about 10 years ago, but then I didn't think it was good enough. And then there was also the problem, I was writing about famous people and I was afraid of being sued. I've signed so many NDAs in my life that I'm just afraid of that. But I paid a lawyer to vet it, and he came back and said, nope, I don't see anything libelous in here at all. Go for it. And that's when I published the book.
And is this, since it's been published, have you, other than your mom being mad at you, have you had anything like, oh, should I put that there? Is there anything that you wish you would re-edit, or is it, this is it? Because I know with like lots of musicians, well, think about it. How many times does like Led Zeppelin go back in the studio and remix or always tweaking songs that have been hit songs for like 30 years that have done incredibly well? They've never liked the second guitar part or something. Is there anything in there that you're like, oh, I should write a companion piece, or I should write a blog piece expanding more on this? Or is there any changes that you would make having now that it's out there?
There, somebody caught one small error in my book, another Depeche Mode fan, and so I wish I could go back and change that. There were one or two other things I wish I had, maybe like lines that I had refined better, but no, not really. At one point, I was going to put some hidden lyrics in the book, 101 after their album Depeche Mode 101, and have a contest to see whoever could find the 101 hidden lyrics. And so that was one version of the book I did, and then I realized I'd have to get clearance on the lyrics, and it costs about $300 per lyric, so it wasn't going to pay off for me. So then I had to go back through the book and take all of those lyrics out. It was only like three words or something, but again, I was afraid of being sued, so I took them out. I was being erring on the side of caution. So that was another version that I did. And there was at one point a wraparound story that kind of wove the whole thing together, and I felt that was superfluous, so that was easy to just take out.
Well, it's a pretty beefy book. I'm looking at it on Amazon. By the way, congratulations on your all 5-star reviews that you've been getting on Amazon, but I've noticed that it's 234 pages long, which is
more reading than I've done.
More higher than I can count, actually. Which is but this must be packed full of just these little stories and vignettes that you've experienced on this 1993 tour. Does one story kind of stand out that is like, if there's any one reason to buy this book, like this story itself is going to hook you in?
I'm guessing it's your foosball story.
I was just telling my niece and nephew about foosball the other night. I was like, look, I love bar games. And actually, bar games is what got me backstage at Depeche Mode. I mean, I was in this small town upper northwestern corner of Spain called Pontevedra. And I went up to the security guards there. My friend said to me, look, they're American. I was like, how do you know? She goes, they have Made in America written on their foreheads, just like you. I'm like, okay, great. I went up to them. Said, hey, I'm from the U.S. Where are you from? New York. Oh, they're like, oh, we're from Detroit. I said, I go to school in Ann Arbor. And they were like, here's backstage passes. And I went backstage, and it turned out I was pretty much the only American back there in this small town. And someone said, hey, does anyone know how to play footy? And they had a foosball table. And I raised my hand. They're like, a female Yank? Okay, let's see what you got. And when they saw that I actually could play foosball, they said, here's backstage passes and tickets for the rest of the tour. Just come backstage every time. And that's how I got backstage, was foosball. So that's that, you know, honing my skills at all the fraternities in Ann Arbor playing foosball helped me get backstage.
I'm so glad the median age of our audience is like 40, because you mentioned AOL, foosball, Depeche Mode. Now, I mean, Depeche Mode is still touring and making music, so they're still relevant, but it's just like, you know, you have to be of a certain era.
Right, right. Well, not only to get AOL, but you made the joke of you still had a few minutes left on the last disc that you got, the free 500 hours. So is your how much does your marketing campaign rely, or is it geared towards the fanatic Depeche Mode world?
That was where, actually, I had pushed my book out. I originally planned to publish it in May or June of this year. And then, and it was all ready to do that and all ready to go. But then I found out while I was living in Berlin, they're having a contest right now. It's called the Takeover Contest. You take over their Facebook page for a day. And I found out that I was the first fan chosen to take over their Facebook page. And I had 2 days' notice to write things for their Facebook page. And I called my book publisher and I said, is there any way we can publish the book in 2 days instead of 3 months from now? They said, we can do the ebook. We can't do the print book. We can do the ebook. So they turned that around for me like in 48 hours so that I could talk about my book on the Depeche Mode Facebook page, because they have 7.6 million fans. So that was, you know, I was catering to them. But I also wrote the book with the intention that anybody could just enjoy this experience. If you love any band, this is how you feel about them.
Weird Al Yankovic.
I've had a few Grateful Dead fans tell me about like how they could totally relate to it. There's been a few other people who mentioned other bands that are vastly different than Depeche Mode. And they're just like, we just get it. You're a music fan. That's what this book is about. And that's why I did not put Depeche Mode in any of the titles, the main title or the subtitle, because I wanted it to appeal to anybody who is a fan of music.
Well, it's true because, you know, management has a similar love affair with a different band of the same ilk. And it's so I know that world and I know how deeply that world runs. I know how, like, sometimes she laments the fact that she has, you know, a friend who's about the same age but doesn't have kids and can still just follow them around. Like, you know, we'll see them in six or seven cities. You know, the closest they are is North Carolina. Well, that's no big deal. I'll just take an extra day off and go down. But not only do they have those loyal followings, like the fanaticism still, you know, and it's funny because, you know, from an outsider looking in, like the different bands, you wouldn't know how big those bands are. But like even Joe said, Joe's Depeche Mode is Weird Al. And all kidding aside, like, you know, Weird Al's doing a tour and he has three nights in Boston, two or three nights?
It's actually two shows in one night.
But it sold out instantly. Like, Joe was so pissed because within seconds of the tickets going on sale, like, all the scalpers got it because they know that they can turn around. And this is Weird Al not doing Weird Al covers. It's just all original stuff. But still, it sold out, like, right away.
Who's your Depeche Mode? Like, who is the band that you would be touring right now? If you had unlimited funds, you would be touring with every city in the world.
They don't exist. Like, honestly, it's like, you know, I saw Buffalo Tom on my birthday back in June. It's the first time they had played in Boston in years. It was absolutely, absolutely, absolutely great. There was no opening act. They played two sets. They played something like 38 songs. It was amazing. And then they were coming back like a few months later, and a couple of my buddies were like, hey, are you going to go? I was like, no, I'm good. It's like, you know, I don't have that. I mean, I've seen all the bands that I really want to see, but even the band, like my favorite bands of all time of any ilk, like a Zeppelin or like a Velvet Underground, I would go see in Boston and then a couple days later in New York. But other than that, it's just, and honestly, I don't know if it's because just having played so long, it's like, you know, going on the road and seeing somebody else play. I mean,
yeah, you've worked in the slaughterhouse, you know how it's made.
I know how the sausage is made, you know. But that said, you know, my obsession with the Patriots, you know, it's like how much I wouldn't go on the road and see them. But I feel that because, you know, here I'm reading trade rumors in the middle of April, 6 months before first game is played. Anyway, but back to the book. So what is the next step with the book? How many different ways are you getting out there? How much time are you, Jenna, on social media on a daily? Is it a job now? Is it a job to get it out there? Or is it you put it out there, you send out some stuff, and you hope word of mouth, or do you actively have to roll up the sleeves and work the book?
I do actively work on the book. I do try to get people to review it. I sent out a blast, which is how you replied to me about this, about how it was nominated for the, or it's made it to the finals for the Book Life Prize. So I do actively do. I probably spend, now I spend like 5 or 6 hours still a week on it, even though it came out officially in May. It came out in March, the ebook, but the print book came out in May. And back then I was spending a lot more time than that. But I found that it's word of mouth that has really just been what has gotten, you know, pushed sales and gotten people to be interested in the book more than almost anything I've done on social media. Because, you know, me saying, hey, come read my book isn't as enticing as someone saying, hey, I read this great book. Come, you got to read this. But yes, I don't spend as much time now on it as I did, but it is, I think most people don't realize if you self-publish a book, and even if you're with a major publishing house these days, if you put a book out, you have to spend almost as much time marketing it as you did writing it. I feel like I've spent more time on the marketing portion and other things like that, building the website, than actually writing the book at this point. And that's something I think a lot of people aren't aware of when they go to write a book. You may write an amazing book, but if no one sees it, then no one knows how great it is. So that's been sort of one of those things that has not been as fun for me. I don't like doing the marketing portion for myself. I love helping my clients do it. But for me, it's like self-promotion. It's like writing your own resume. I know everyone hates to write their own resume. And that's what I kind of feel like I'm doing here. But it's been a lot of fun. And I've met some amazing people because of it. I had one fan track me down on Facebook. And we were messaging back and forth. And he finally said, is it okay if I FaceTime you? And I said, okay. And so he did, and he goes, I'm sorry, I'm in California traffic, so I can't be texting the whole time. That's why I wanted to call.
All right. Said, okay, so you didn't hit FaceTime and he's naked, you know, just standing.
No. And it turned out he had some similar stories too, and there were other people who just told me how like they could relate to it so much, and I've other people saying that they were just so jealous that I got to be so close to them, and And I think it's also fun. And actually, I went to a concert of theirs in Connecticut a few weeks ago, and I gave a copy. I was walking with a copy of my book, which the cover of the book is designed to look very similar to their album, Faithful Songs of Faith and Devotion, which is the tour I was on, which is where I got the title from. And so anybody who sees the cover who's a Depeche Mode fan is going to know that this is a Depeche Mode book. And as I was walking back to give it to the manager, someone's like, "What is that? How come I don't have that?" And then he started taking pictures of me with me and like getting excited that he was standing next to me. And I'm like, "I'm no one to be excited about. You know, this is it's not a big deal." But then I was posted on social media with him holding the book, and he was all excited.
So if you had one of two things, it's like you get like, you know, members of the band like texting you saying, "Oh my God, thank you for writing this book. It was awesome." Or get the notification from Amazon that, you know, you just sold 100,000 copies. Which would be more satisfying? Yeah, granted, the money aspect would be more satisfying. But if you could have one of the two things happen, the band write and say, "Oh my God, thank you for writing the book. It's the greatest thing." Or you got 100,000 sales. You can pick one of the two doors. Which one are you walking through?
I don't think any of them would say that they loved it, because this tour, it was Q Magazine, a very popular British magazine, called this tour the most debaucherous tour in rock and roll history, because this was the time when Dave Gahn was on heroin and the other members of the band were pretty drugged out or drunks at the time. So I'm not giving anything away by saying that. That's one of the reasons why I wanted my book reviewed for a lawyer for libel, because I'm talking about how trash they were all the time. I don't think they would come back to me and say, "We love this book. Thank you for reliving the darkest days of our lives." So I would go with the money on that point, because the other one's not going to happen.
Wait. You said doing drugs and alcohol like it's a bad thing.
Well, you know why my mom wasn't talking to me for a while.
So so plug away all the ways that people can find the book and find you if you want to be found.
I have my website, jennarobbins.com, JennaRobbins, because a lot of people spell my name with one B. It's on Amazon. If you do a search for Faithful and Devoted, it's usually the first one that comes up now. There's another Faithful and Devoted that's about quilting, so I don't think you're going to want that one if you're a music fan, probably.
Wait a minute.
hold on a minute. Don't be besmirching the great world of knitting.
Quilting, sir. Well,
quilting.
If you're looking for something, you know, you want to find the thing you're looking for. You're not looking for quilting right now. You're looking for the music. That's all.
Okay.
Sure, it's a fine book. But yeah, so those are the two best ways. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram. A lot of my handles, a lot of time I use the handle St. Jenna, STJENNA. I didn't want to have a number after my name, and it was the one thing that I could think of that was not taken in most places, although there is someone now who's trying to steal those and new accounts, setting up new accounts under my name, and it's not me. But yeah, so those are the ways you can find me, and I'd love to hear from anybody who's interested.
And you're open to strangers tracking you down and FaceTiming with you while they're in traffic.
I looked at the guy's Facebook page itself, and I could tell he was a Depeche Mode fan and all this stuff, so I didn't think it was going to be a big problem. And I'm usually pretty good at vetting those things now that I've worked in the social media world for a while, so yeah.
Any last questions there? You guys?
No, I just want to wish Jenna good luck on the Book Life Award.
Well, thank you very much. I'll find out in December. And Joe, I just want to let you know that I actually played pinball with Weird Al one time.
Well, you can't drop that and go.
Now we have to add 20 more minutes to the podcast.
Sit back down, everyone. But quickly, where was it?
Actually, it was at a Christmas party for one of the guys who created South Park. And so there were all these strange celebrities walking around, and they had a pinball machine. I believe it was a South Park pinball machine. And I ended up playing a game with Weird Al.
And you let him win, of course, right?
I honestly don't remember how that turned out, because some other horrible things happened that evening to me personally that is not exciting for this podcast. Nothing to do with anybody fun or famous. And I ended up having to leave the party early. So I don't really – what I remember most from that party. Although the playing pinball with Weird Al was great. And I actually saw him at an airport like maybe 2 years ago. It was right after his Word Crimes came out. And I wanted to go over and say to him, thank you for doing that song, because I always loved the beat of the original. What was the original of Word Crimes? Blurred Lines.
Well, Marvin Gaye, but let's not get into the semantics.
But I hated the whole context, and the video was so much misogynistic. I hated the fact that I would sing that song.
What's wrong with misogynists?
But then when he did Blurred Lines, it made it okay for me to do that. And I wanted to go over and say that to him, but he didn't seem to want to be bothered. And I also wanted to say, hey, good pinball game, by the way. And I decided to let him be.
So we will post on what little social media we have, like the link to the book on Amazon, the link to the contest, and we will implore our listeners, Biff, talking right to you, go to Amazon, download this, write a review.
We were just actually hoping that you would plug our podcast on your book
on
tour.
On your book tour, so right, exactly.
When you go on Ellen next week, if you could just mention the podcast, we'd be much appreciated.
But Jenna,
well, and also, there have been a few people who have bought the book, wanted a signed copy, have mailed it to me with a return envelope, and I've mailed it back and done that for them. The only problem with that right now is I am traveling around the U.S. and I'm in a new place every couple of weeks. So I never know where I can have people mail it to. But we could work something out. If that's something someone would like, I'm happy to do it. I think it's really fun. I think that's a really great thing for fans to ask.
So seriously, Jenna, thank you for making time to come on this. And congratulations. I know like it's been such a labor of love because, like I said, I've known you 15, 16 years and you've been talking about like this week with Depeche Mode since I've known you. So it's got to be good to finally have it out there despite what Mom thinks. But congratulations on that. Good luck with everything. And seriously, anybody out there who is listening, please, like, you know, go to the page when at the bottom of the description of this show and click on the links and follow Jenna because it's a fun follow, and go read the book.
Thank you so much, guys.
Oh, and lastly, do not forget...